Good evening.
So, Western scholars, scholars of Buddhism, the Western scholars say that Buddhism in Japan is now stagnant. And they say, you know, when you visit Japan, you can see the effect of the Buddhist tradition. You can see it in the art, in the culture, in the way people behave. And it is a really wonderful feeling. It's very inspiring when you go to Japan and you feel the effect of the Buddhist tradition. But these scholars say that today Buddhism is simply social. It's within social customs now. It is no longer creative. It is a kind of a passive thing. They say Buddhism in Japan has no vitality and no life, no life force. And the reason that they give, and I don't know how true, but they say Buddhism has penetrated too deeply into the daily life of the people. Penetrated too deeply. So that today it is accepted automatically without consideration. It has a social influence in the country, in the culture, but this influence is just on the surface. That is, they mean that Buddhism no longer has much influence, and people have no understanding, no real understanding of it, because they've been immersed in it for so long. So there are no reflections on the kinds of questions that inspired Buddhism centuries ago. There are no questions, no reflections. People just accept what they have and don't bother about reflecting on it. And the problem is that the Buddhism that people have grown up with, that they've always had, is they already have at their fingertips somebody else's answer to the big questions, to the big concerns about life. Somebody else's answer that was developed, you know, centuries ago. So they say in Japan, no such thing as beginner's mind. It's like there are no irritants in the oyster that can create a pearl. You know, for the oyster to create a pearl, there has to be some little grain, some irritant that causes the creativity of the pearl, and there's no irritant in the Buddhist culture of Japan, they say. I don't know exactly how true all of that is, but I think it is a truth, a good point, that it's only when we reflect, only when we have questions and doubts about our life, can we develop the energy for transforming the old into something new. Only with our doubts can we provide the energy for some new growth and for continual birth. And of course, without new growth, there is stagnation. This, I think, is very true. So it is a kind of a problem for humans, you know, when a new tradition is started, new creative and vibrant, inspiring tradition is started. It's always started by a non-traditionalist. Somebody who is seen within the current tradition to be radical. Not a conservative, but more a revolutionary for something new. Non-traditionalist who says, who has a new vision that can capture the hearts and the minds of others. And this is how new traditions start. The founder brings, creates great excitement and energy. And so for a short time, for maybe 1, 2, 3 generations, for a short time, people live in the joy of this creative new tradition, this creative discovery. They live in the joy of it. But after a time, after several generations, the tradition hardens. Nothing new. Nothing new. And that what was once a creative tradition becomes a habit. And the tradition tries to preserve the old and not create something new. And the conservatives of this tradition now try to insist upon keeping the old ways and reject anything new. So without some new revolutionary tradition becomes stagnant with conservatives and bureaucracies. And I think we see that today. So that is a problem that we have to always watch out for. And it is one of the features behind the very, very famous saying, you know, when you meet the Buddha on the road, kill him. You know, that sounds very blasphemous. What? Kill the Buddha. But it really means if here come the answers, here comes the book of answers, throw it away. Don't rely on Buddha to bring you all the answers. Kill him. Find your own answers. So originally, Buddhism was very creative. There was no previous Buddha to provide answers to this new tradition. So originally, Buddhism was bold and innovative and brought a new understanding to life, of life. It was a new practice that had its effect both socially, communally, and as for individuals. And one good example of how Buddhism created a new tradition was in the caste system of India, where the Buddhism was born, the caste system. And as you probably know, the caste system, the 5 levels, people are put in levels based on their occupation. Warriors and kings are at the top, and then the merchants, and at the bottom are the so-called untouchables. So there was this caste system, and and that the people in the top caste were considered to be the virtuous ones. So Buddhism came along and brought a new idea about who is noble. and who has virtue? And it said, it's not somebody put in a system at the top. Noble was not something that's in the blood. It's not something that you are born with, and it is not about your knowledge. In Buddhism, it was a person's virtue that determined their true status, not how they were born. So Buddha received a lot of criticism for that new idea, a lot of flack from the conservatives who liked what they had. So it was brand new, and it inspired many people. Virtue determined the true status of an individual. And that virtue included someone who mastered their senses, who mastered their cravings, who didn't give in to their desires, the person who was not attached to ideas about their self, and who could see a large reality that went beyond the differences of people. So that's one way. The new tradition of Buddhism brought new insight to the true way of the world. And so in Buddhism, the noble person was not just a king or a wonderful warrior. The noble person was someone who had five virtues. And these were listed as patience, energy, meditation, wisdom, and compassion. And this new model of a noble person was revolutionary. And it changed the whole society of India and created a tradition of virtue. And so this is the kind of thing that can happen when somebody questions an old tradition and creates a new one. And change everything for everybody's benefit. So this kind of creativity of a new tradition, a kind of spiritual creativity, is very difficult in a society that is bound up in its tradition and won't let go and won't listen to anything new. It could be religious society or material society, individuals or communities, bound in tradition, bound in old ways of thinking, stubbornly refusing to open the door to new insights, new feelings, and new ideas. Now, in the modern world, the traditions that we have these days that began, well, I don't know, 500 years ago, something like that, modern traditions emphasize self-fulfillment. Based on being independent and self-centered. These are our traditions even today. And these modern traditions that are based on self-fulfillment don't see any payoff in virtue. You know, what is the value of virtue? Can I put it in the bank? No payoff for virtue. So this is tradition we have in the Western world today. In the tradition in the world we live in today says that the payoff comes out of our ambition, comes out of our success, solving technical problems and creating wealth, providing entertainment, adding value, those things that you read about and what they teach in the business school. So today, our traditions that are continuing to evolve emphasize the individual, which says to get along you have to be competitive and you have to be tough-minded. But I think today some people are beginning to question that. Like you. Like us. If we want to know who we are truly, if we want to know our true self, we cannot simply emphasize the things that give us material payoff or emotional payoff. If we want to know our true self, that's what we're beginning to recognize. So there's a beginning in this, in the Western world, that says we shouldn't just emphasize creating wealth or creating value. We shouldn't just emphasize our individual self. There's a new tradition trying to be born. But it's always hard to change an old tradition. It takes time, determination, and patience. And there is also the growing idea that we should put some emphasis on the idea of virtue. So there's a story about the very famous Joshu in China. He's walking on the road going somewhere and a monk is coming the other way. And it's traditional, as you know, you stop and you bow to someone who you're approaching. So the monk stopped and bowed to Joshu in the traditional way, and Joshu slapped him. And the monk said, "Well, am I not supposed to pay respect? Isn't it laudable to pay respect to someone you meet?" And Joshu said, "Yes, but it's better to go without a laudable thing." So Joshu recognized, when he saw this monk, he saw in his demeanor, in his body, in his facial expression, that it was just routine. That his bow was just, "Well, this is the tradition." And Joshu saw that, and so he slapped him. Go without a laudable thing. Don't do it just because it's the right thing to do, because people call it laudable. What he's really telling this monk is, when you bow, full body and mind, not just cursory. That's the way those old Zen masters were in the 8th and 9th century. They would see something and they would react in a shocking way in order to wake people up, without an explanation, like I just did. Without explaining why they did it, he slapped him. So, our practice is the expression of our true self. Not the polite self, the true self. And what is the true self? It is a question and an answer at the same time. And it's a question we each have to answer for ourselves. We each have to answer our own question. Best not to look in Buddhist scriptures for the answer to the question, what is the true self? Kill the Buddha. It's the question, an important question that each of us has to work on for ourselves. We should not allow or encourage anyone to provide us an answer. And this question is actually the center of our life. Life flows around this question, this answer, and this understanding. It is like a circle without circumference. This question and this answer, and this seeking for understanding. Circle without circumference. And it has to be circular, because if we allow our life to become, you know, linear, just a formula or a progression, if our life is linear, we are actually far from our true life. To have a linear life means we will always be on the lookout to use somebody else's understanding, so that then we can say, oh, I understand. I got it from the, you know, Google or the internet or this book. And that's stagnation. So Lingzhi said that when you encounter Buddha, kill the Buddha, only thus does one become free. Of course, our tradition we have today does not encourage that. It sees things in a linear way. So, with our intellect and our emotion, we first raise a question, well, who am I? What is my life? Or what is the meaning of life? But the intellect and emotion are not qualified to answer. Not qualified. And our tradition that we have these days promises to provide an answer to the meaning of life. But our tradition is not qualified. So how we answer that question, what is the meaning of life? How we answer that question is not with our brains or emotion or our belief or our custom. In order to answer the question, what is the meaning of my life? In order to know who am I really, we have to have an interview with who we are before we were born. This is the only way to recognize our true self. We must come face to face and have an interview with who you are. And so, as we know, Buddhism says, and we buy into it, that everyone has Buddha nature. This is an important concept in Buddhism. Everyone is equal. Everyone has Buddha nature. So the monk Ero said to his teacher Sekito, what is Buddha? And Sekito says, you have no Buddha nature. What? Ero says, why not? And Sekito says, because you do not recognize yourself. You know, it's one thing to say, okay, my tradition says everyone has Buddha nature. Isn't that cool? Isn't that great? I'm the same as everybody. Oh, good deal. And Sekito says, that's somebody else's answer. Who are you really? You don't recognize yourself. So only through our sitting practice can we recognize ourselves. So we begin each day and each moment with a continuous revolution. Every day when we start our day with our practice, we set aside everything we've learned about our tradition. When we just sit with nothing on our mind, we are throwing away everything we've been carrying around about our tradition. Every truth that we came to believe and every answer that we rely on, we throw them away and sit. Start a new tradition every day in our own small way. This way, our tradition doesn't become automatic and it does not become a habit. Becomes fresh every day through our own effort. So we have to be careful not to allow our habits to become a tradition. It's up to us, each of us, to express spiritual creativity through our practice. Does anyone have a question? Yes, Brenda. What is a standard? Don't make up anything that you call your own. Don't make up anything. Because if you do, that can lead to pride, arrogance. Look what I made up. Look what I created. So it's a kind of warning. Don't make up anything on your own. Whatever you discover has to be universal and not yours. Don't consider it to be yours. Don't don't make up anything. So it can be an interesting dilemma. Because traditions do create a feeling of community for people, and they feel support for each other and trust for each other when they participate in a common tradition. So we do it, but we do it knowing that it's a way to hold us together, but it shouldn't get in the way of we make our own discoveries. So it's a careful balance. So we don't make up standards on our own in order to keep the community together, but we don't give up our inquiry. Thank you.
Buddhism is relatively new in the United States. Do you think that there will come a time when that will become dogmatic, or that the tradition could harden, as what these scholars were saying has happened in Japan, where it's just either taken for granted or taken into the realm of dogma that hardens and doesn't allow for flow and change?
No, I don't think so. I think there will be increasingly in the coming century, I think there will increasingly be people who start to make inquiries about the practice and about Buddhism, and it will be individual seeking, but it won't be a selfish seeking. It'll be a seeking, personal seeking, done with care and concern and compassion and selflessness. And I think rather than see wholesale change, all of a sudden America is Buddhist, I don't think that will happen. I think we will see, like the Suzuki Roshi's statement saying, and it became a book, just we shine our light on one corner of the world, that's all we need to do. And I think that will happen. Here and there, we will see more and more pockets of light, something like that. And those will be places where people can come to practice and learn about the practice, and then take it with them wherever they go. But I don't think all of society will become like Tibet or something, where everybody is Buddhist. I don't think so. I doubt that that can happen. But I think there will be some growth in the interest in the practice and in people participating in the practice as they have more and more questions about the lifestyles that are being developed here, that are so intense and seem to allow no room. People will say, wait a minute, wait, what's going on here? And they will start to think about other ways. So I don't think there will be a hardening. Thank you. Dave.
I was very intrigued by a phrase you used early in your talk, when you said that Buddhism in Japan had sunk in so thoroughly that it was only on the surface. I like that very much.
Oh.
It sort of reminds me of the idea that the fish doesn't discover the water and the bird doesn't discover the air. I think what you just said about our culture in this country, I mean, there are certainly many things in this country that are very disturbing, but you talked about the individual selfishness and so forth, but one of the things that we do have is this multifaceted view of religion and people seeing each other's religions, learning about each other's religions, unlike a society where the religion has permeated so thoroughly that people can't even see it.
I don't think that will happen here with Buddhism. Maybe it's happened here with Christianity. You know, maybe it's true for Christianity in this country, but I don't think it will happen with Buddhism in this country. Anyway, we have the rest of the century to find out. Thank you. Oh, Rich.
Perhaps someday in the future, an American can bring Buddhism to Japan.
I don't know. You know, you mean a sort of American Suzuki Roshi going the other way?
I just meant as societies change, as you described, you know, there can be a shift, and, you know, we learn from each other through cultural exchange. I meant like in the distant future.
Yes.
I get a little carried away.
Yes. We don't know. We don't know what will happen. Maybe there'll be a lot of tourists from Japan. They come to here and they say, oh, look what the Americans are doing. They're doing Buddhism. Let's go back and do that. We don't know. It's fun to wait and see and observe. Thank you. Yes, please.
Do you think there is something very unique about Buddhism coming to America? I mean, it reminds me of an old Indian saying that says, sometimes two things have attraction to each other, but the attraction is not sufficient. They have to actually meet and something new happens. Do you think there was attraction between Buddhism and America? I mean, the people here, is it like a good natural fit in some ways? Because, you know,
well, interest in Zen Buddhism in this country came about because some Japanese teachers came here. You know, Buddhism has been in this country for, you know, about a century, but it was not the Zen Buddhism. It was an Asian kind of Buddhism that we see in China and Thailand and places like that. But what we're doing here is because five or six men and women came from Japan. And when they presented it or made it possible, Americans said, that's really interesting. So there was some attraction once it was presented to them. You know, those five or six teachers from Japan, they didn't go home because they said, oh, nobody's interested. I failed. they got planted here because people were interested. So you're right, there was some attraction. So this interest is growing slowly, and you know, it's hard to imagine that the remainder of the 21st century will be any different than the first 20 years in terms of what's going on in the culture. More quest for efficiency, productivity, technology, improvement of lifestyle, accumulation of wealth, all these things that we've witnessed in the last 20 years or so. I can't imagine we'll be doing it any differently in the next, for the rest of the century. Probably more intense. And as it does get more intense, the people who have to make it run will feel more pressure because there's more technology to learn, more information to absorb, more emphasis and pressure to be efficient, and more pressure on personal freedoms. So I think people are going to start to search for or think about that life, that kind of life that doesn't provide the satisfactions that they want. They're going to start thinking about it and saying there's got to be another way. And so I think interest in this practice will increase in the coming years. Because we've kind of reaching a limit in what we can handle, what we can tolerate. Thank you. Yes, Carolina.
What you're saying about how everything is increasing and we're becoming more materialistic and more self-centered and forgetting who we are. I think that there was a politician, and she ran for governor, Megan, I can't remember her last name. Who is a Republican. And she came out, she made a statement, and she said that person who's running as the Republican nominee for the president is an affront to our national character. And I think that at this point in time, I think we have an unusual election right now, and I think that it's really going to the heart of things. And I think this you know, we don't talk about politics, but, you know, with Bernie Sanders and what he was bringing up, I mean, just really deep, you know, who are we? You know, who is America? What do we stand for? Those questions are really being asked right now. And I think that this candidate, Trump, might be the best thing that's ever happened to us. The answer to the question, who are we? Who are we? Are we a virtuous nation? You know? Do we accept others? Do we lie? Do we, you know, declare bankruptcy and other people have to pick up the pieces? Those are questions of value and character. And we're we can look at that. And I think people are looking at that.
Okay.